Namaste, everyone. Today, I thought it would be nice to have a contemplation on meditation. A meditation on meditation, we can call it. An understanding of meditation in Advaita, Jnana Yoga, non-duality. I will read out two sentences on meditation. In fact, this is how the thought came to me that the subject should be meditation this morning. One is from Ramana Maharshi. It is from a book which I have been looking at for an upcoming talk on Ramana Maharshi's teachings. It is necessary to practice meditation frequently and regularly until the condition induced becomes habitual and permanent throughout the day. Therefore, meditate. This is very important because the emphasis is not on the practice of meditation, but on what Ramana Maharshi says throughout the day, you see, until the condition induced becomes habitual and permanent throughout the day, means whether at work, whether at home, no matter what is going on the movie screen of one's life. So what is being pointed at here is a state of being, not as a practice of meditation, but as a state of being. Now let's see what Nisargadatta Maharaj says. Our consciousness is the form of God, and it is a sin not to meditate on it. What is the ultimate thing that we have to accomplish? It is silence. For that, it is necessary to meditate. Two short sentences that sum up meditation, the purpose of meditation, one could say. There are many definitions, there are many practices of meditation, but we are looking at those who are drawn to this teaching of Advaita. What is meditation? You will have to excuse me for a minute because I forgot to clip on the mic which I was supposed to for the recording, so I'll go and get it. But when I speak, you may keep your eyes open or closed. Whatever comes out of this mouth comes unplanned, but it will show aspects and throw light on meditation, perhaps for 15 or 20 minutes or so. So please excuse me for a minute. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay. Apologies for that. Okay. So I would like to see everyone and then we can begin. The first point is that meditation does not have a goal. It is not goal oriented. It is the ego that is goal oriented, which would like to have an outcome of the meditation. And when the ego does not get the desired outcome, it gets frustrated and therefore judges the practice of meditation as being ineffective. If one was to ask, what is the purpose of meditation? The only purpose as such is witnessing whatever takes place on the screen of consciousness. So let's say you fix a certain time in the day, a time where you are least likely to be disturbed, and a fixed time because the body has a biorhythm. It automatically slips into that mode once it gets accustomed to it. A fixed place because of the vibration which is carried in the body. That is why in our ashrams, the asana, the seat, is revered, because that is not just a seat for respect. That seat carries the vibration. So these are good to note initially. They help, they don't harm, let's put it that way. It's not necessary, nothing is necessary. But these are just put out there. So if it appeals to someone, for example, if their nature is to be disciplined and they like sitting at a certain time in a certain place, there are benefits to be derived. If one's lifestyle does not allow that, that's fair enough. Because of course, ultimately the journey of meditation is the journey within. Now what happens when one sits for meditation? There are a couple of pointers here. One, thoughts are bound to arise. It does not mean one has not had a good meditation, so to speak. The difference is, when one is sitting and thoughts arise, the opportunity is given to know that thoughts are arising. Because otherwise, during the day, we are lost in thoughts. We are lost in thoughts and we get consumed by thoughts. And that thought gets stretched into thinking. And that is when we run away with the thoughts, which is what the ego does. It stretches the thought in the duration of time, and thinking begins. Mostly, that thinking is thinking about the dead past or an imaginary future. So with meditation, with sitting in silence, whatever arises is witnessed without the least attempt to stop thoughts from arising. This is another very important point, because It is the ego that wants to control the meditation. It is the ego that wants to stop thoughts from arising in order to get a result. This is how the ego starts coming in through the back door to assert itself again and again and again. Now, it has been proved over the years, right from my spiritual teacher's time to articles we can read even today, that we have no control over what the next thought is going to be. Now, if we have no control over what the next thought is going to be, who is the one who thinks it can control the arising of thoughts itself? The point is, in meditation, the thoughts arising are witnessed. That is all. The thoughts arising are witnessed, just as one witnesses traffic going by on a street. Now, what tends to happen is one tends to get involved in thinking quite automatically. A thought arises, maybe a thought of work, let's say. I have to submit this paper tomorrow. And then you start processing in the mind what you have to do, how do you have to go about it. This happens in meditation itself. It can happen. The running away with the thought in the duration of time also cannot be controlled. It happens. It happens. But at some point, the awareness comes. Oh God, I was involved in thinking. I was thinking about my work. And when that thought comes, that thinking is cut off. Awareness arose that I was involved in thinking. While I was meditating, I got consumed by a thought and I was involved in thinking. That awareness itself cuts off the involvement. Even that awareness is not yours. That awareness coming is not your awareness coming. It comes. So it's okay. Sometimes the meditation, I am not running away with too many thoughts. Sometimes I am. It's okay. But what happens by and by, one will find over time that these instances of running away with the thought into excessive thinking reduce. Why? Because one is getting established more and more in witnessing. Now, Nisargadatta Maharaj has given a simple and beautiful pointer for meditation. Abide in your being. Just sit and abide in your being. The fact that you are conscious right here, right now, simply stay with that. You are. This is your being. Because throughout the day, you are so busy with running around, doing things, that we forget that we are. We forget the human being and we become the human becoming. So when one is abiding in one's being, this focus which was going out reverses, comes back in. As Rameshji translated, abide in your being, he said, consciousness contemplating on consciousness, not on the things of the world, not on the objects of the world, not on the objects of thoughts, but the fact that consciousness is contemplating on itself. Abide in your being. Rest in your being. Consciousness contemplating on consciousness is non-dual devotion. Consciousness contemplating on consciousness is obviously non-dual devotion, because then there are not two, because consciousness is contemplating on itself. It is devoted to itself. That is why Maharaj said that consciousness is the God of gods, because without consciousness, which God can manifest? And in fact, he would say that when you wake up, let the first thought be this: consciousness is the God of gods. And before going to sleep, let the last thought be, consciousness is the God of gods. I am. Propitiate the consciousness. And when Maharaj says silence, as I read out in the quote, he is referring to the silence of the mind. Now, in daily living, when the thinking mind of the ego starts getting dissolved, how? By accepting that whatever happens is the will of God, the will of consciousness, the will of the source, and accepting that nobody is truly the doer of their actions, neither myself nor others. What is happening is when the thinking mind, which was so consuming, such a burden of blame, accusation, hatred, jealousy, envy, pride and arrogance, and so on, when none of that is operating anymore, as a result of imbibing the teaching, one is automatically resting in one's being. A thinking mind at rest means the presence of pure presence. One is present to what is. When your judgments are gone out of the window and all your finger pointing, not only at others, but at yourself and at God also. Why did you do this to me? When all that goes out of the window, you are naturally, automatically abiding in your being. And one starts witnessing life more and more, witnessing the pleasures of life, witnessing the pains of life. That is meditation during the day. Meditation is the waking up from the living dream of life. Pleasure is enjoyed, knowing that it won't last, and knowing that pleasure does not give me true happiness. Pain is endured as pain, which is not converted to psychological suffering. That is meditation. In daily living, what one finds that if there is a reaction to what someone says or to an event that has happened, the involvement in that reaction reduces. The reaction can still take place because of years and years of accumulated conditioning. But one now finds, with the understanding, that one is involved less and less in the reaction. Or one finds that one's reactions are now converted to responses. So this is the essence. After all, the whole teaching is the teaching of non-doership. So you cannot do meditation. It is a way to be. You will find that during the course of the day, you are more and more present to what is arising in the moment. What Maharaj called driving a wedge between experiencing and being. So these blind knee-jerk reactions, driven by the fuel of past conditioning, these blind knee-jerk reactions can start transforming. This is called a meditative way of living. There is no point in a practice of meditation, whether it is 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, if there is no direct impact on one's daily living. Because then you can be sure, if there is no direct impact in peace of mind in daily living, then that meditation practice is strengthening the ego. They are not separate. They are not two. Meditation as a practice is a gateway so that the fresh conditioning generated in the practice of meditation starts permeating one's daily living. Someone who is of a deeply peaceful and meditative nature, by and by, at peace with what happens, need not even sit in silence for half an hour to meditate. Yet for most of us, It is an important stepping stone for Maharaj himself, who was so resistant to the idea of meeting a guru. When his friend kept forcing him and he kept saying no, 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 and then literally his friend dragged him to his guru. And all his gurus said to Maharaj was, always remember, you are that. And Maharaj said for 3 years, that was all that was on Maharaj's mind, to be I am that, to abide in being. And after 3 years, he reached the realization. And these highest teachings have been distilled for us by sages like Maharaj, by Ramana Maharshi, my own teacher who was a banker, brought it down to practical daily living, explained meditation in the simplest of terms. It is a gift for all of us. We all know the value of a silent mind. Most underrated, our own experience of deep sleep where the mind is completely quiet proves to us the value of a silent mind, especially in challenging times like these. Health situations, job losses, stresses of people living under the same roof for months on end. Dealing with others, uncertain futures, conflict, the unknown staring us in the face. It is at times like this that the spiritual teachings come forward. To sail through the storms of life. Isn't it an irony in the Western world when they bury someone on the grave, it is on the tombstone, it is written, rest in peace. Means your life was not peaceful. So now at least rest in peace. When you are absent, you can rest in peace. In deep sleep, you can rest in peace. And these teachings are showing the way to rest in peace in daily living by resting in one's being, by witnessing the show of one's life on the screen of consciousness, the ups and downs, the highs and lows, the pleasures and pains, knowing this too shall pass. To end on a lighter note, on the subject of meditation, there was a meditation camp being conducted in prison for the prisoners. So at the end of the meditation, they asked the prisoners to share their experience. So one prisoner put his hand up. He was the most notorious. Everyone was scared of him. So the jail warden was shocked that this man put his hand up. And he said, yes, please share your experience of meditation. And this prisoner said, you know, I kept hearing all the time that meditation gives clarity. Meditation leads to a clear mind. And I actually had the experience of that during this half an hour. So everyone was so pleasantly surprised. So the jail warden said, "Can you explain to us?" He said, "Absolutely, very simple. Before meditation, I was boiling inside. I felt like killing someone. And after the meditation, I know who." Clarity. That is why we find many people get answers to their problems, answers to work situations when they sit for meditation. Why? Simply because the thinking mind, which had got so entangled with the problem, that things became cloudy, things became gray. That thinking mind is given an opportunity to disengage from the situation. And we feel, wow, you know, this is how to do it. This kind of clarity has come in my relationship with someone, in a work situation. That does happen. But that happens not because the ego has found a solution to a problem in meditation. That happens because the light of clarity does shine because the ego is at rest. It is viewing things more objectively. And therefore, answers do come. Answers do come. All right. So we can now start any questions, answers, sharing. Answers do come, but the point is we have to be available for them, you see. We are so invested in outcomes, in the way we think things should be. We want specific answers. Okay. Yes, Pratyush.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Sir, I was actually 25 years old. I am from Bhopal. I started practicing and reading Nisargadatta Maharaj just few months back. Actually, just 1 month back.
Mm-hmm.
And can I speak in Hindi?
It's okay. I'll try and translate, though my Hindi isn't the best. But don't blame me because I was brought up in a Jesuit school. Okay, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, Pratyush, can you? Yeah. Are you there?
I think you're not moving.
Are you moving by any chance?
Yes, sir.
If you don't move, it might be easier because otherwise the feed gets broken sometimes.
Okay, sir. I have gone through a kind of psychological suffering about 23-24 years by chasing different types of thoughts. Mujhe aisa laga ki main thoughts hoon. I believed in my thoughts.
Yes.
And after that, just 1 month back, I started reading Papaji, Punjaji, disciple of Ramana Maharshi. And I tried Who Am I and residing in I Am. And it just, I was at a different type of healing for so feeling out of suffering, but it didn't work exactly. But when I read Punjaji, see his videos, then Muji, then Nisargadatta Maharaj, and I'm just out of suffering. And I'm very happy, first time in my life.
Great.
I recognized I am not my thoughts. I am not anything. And it's good to be nothing actually.
Yeah, but many people try and they can't be nothing, right?
Yes, actually nothing is a quality, like abstract quality, like peace. Love is peace. Everything is peace.
There's a Zen saying, it's never too late to do nothing.
Yes, sir. Sir, actually, I want to ask, there is one quote by Nisargadatta Maharaj. He says, for the meditation, abide in the I Am, pure spontaneous awareness, and then go beyond the I Am.
Yes.
I did not understand what is go beyond the pure awareness.
Yes, that's a long subject, Pratyush, so we should not get into that too much right now. But what Maharaj is pointing to is what is consciousness and what is prior to consciousness. Prior to consciousness, which is awareness not aware of itself, which is Parabrahman, and consciousness as Brahman. You see, so I don't want this to get too conceptual a talk, so we will let it rest there. But if you read Maharaj's books, keeping this in mind, that consciousness between I am and I am that is not aware of itself, which is the unmanifest I am, which he refers to as Parabrahman. So he says that even the consciousness can be witnessed, you see. So he drew this distinction between consciousness and awareness. So you could explore that further, or we can take it up at another talk. But it's good because it shows that you are diving deep into the teachings. So all the best to you for that. And I'm glad that you're smiling and happy.
Sir, in beyond the I am, do I have to just remain in the consciousness only, in the pure awareness?
You don't have to do anything. But yes, in that sense, I mean, forget the beyond the I am, because the beyond the I am is also a thought in I am, right?
Yes, yes, sir.
What Maharaj is saying is that you will automatically be pulled to that if you are resting in your being. So that will do the job. So don't let it be something else to achieve or to do as such.
Okay, sir.
Yeah?
Yes,
sir. Okay.
Sir, Ramesh Balchakar, sir, teachings also helped me a lot.
Good, good. You're in good company.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Aki.
Hi, Gautam.
Hello.
Gautam, Ramana Maharshi always says, who am I? You know, investigate on who am I.
Uh-huh.
And that is when you get to know your true self. Gautam, if you could help us understand what is the process, or you know, what is the approach we need to follow? I mean, how do we, what is the method, right, to investigate? Yeah, investigating is like asking yourself a question like, who am I? But how does it progress further? I mean, I'm clueless about that approach. If you could just guide us on that, that would be really helpful.
Oh God, that is another satsang as well. It's very simple, Aki, at one level. What Bhagwan is pointing at is that if you get an answer to who am I, that is always the incorrect answer. Because there will always be one step before that, that which is aware of that answer. You see, so what is happening is, what with who am I, you are retreating, reversing back to your true self. Because, for example, you know, this thought came to me, who am I? You know, that investigation will lead to another thought. Who am I? Who is the one who had that thought? So this is a practice which recedes the ego, the thinking mind, to its source. And at that stage, questions don't get answered. They don't arise anymore. They rest. So there will never be an answer to who am I? Because that answer will come from the ego. And if there is an answer, then again the question is posed, who is the me who is now getting this answer? Then again it happens. That is a real beautiful practice, but it requires a lot of dedication, not a fly-by-night kind of, you know, for 15 minutes I'm just going to ask who am I and the rest of the day I won't. Because therefore the emphasis on the practice impacting daily living. So supposing a thought of jealousy arises during the day, then this also is applied then. Who is this entity that is feeling jealousy? Who am I? You see, it is not just this limited half-na practice. This who am I becomes a way of being. And I would love to explore it further, perhaps at another talk. We might be doing a specific talk on Ramana Maharshi's teachings very soon. It will be on a Sunday morning itself. And an email will be sent out. So I think you might enjoy that.
Absolutely, Gautam, that would be really great. And Gautam, because I've been reading a lot about Ramana Maharshi and all that, there is one question which comes into my head. Sorry if it's a ridiculous question, but see, I mean, Ramana Maharshi never had any official education. He never went to any school, I mean, maybe schools or colleges or whatsoever. But during his discourses, during his satsangs, when devotees used to ask him questions, he used to exhibit such amazing knowledge about Upanishads, Vedas. He was aware of all of them. How is it possible? I mean, what was the source of this knowledge? I mean, from where does he get it?
Oh, that came later, Akhi. That came later. You see, one is the experience of awakening and enlightenment and realization. But even masters like Nisargadatta Maharaj, who was primarily uneducated, he would also reference the Gita, he would reference the scriptures. Because post that event, they got validation through the scriptures itself that, you know, this is what it says. And so they started quoting that. It's not that they pulled it out of thin air or anything.
Okay.
Because in fact, if you read, I've read so many of Ramana Maharshi's books, like, you know, Day by Day with Bhagwan, Letters and so on. He is constantly shown as if he's reading stuff and, you know, asking to pull out a book from the bookshelf and all that. So they are surrounded by this also.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Thanks, Gautam.
But yet, the beauty is that this teaching of Ramana Maharshi, of Nisargadatta Maharaj, of Ramesh Balsekar and so on is so practical, so pragmatic, because it is a direct experience, you see. It is not someone who has read the scriptures and then started talking. And I think, I don't know if you watched the earlier talks at my home, the videos of which are there, I gave this example of someone in Bombay attending Vedanta classes and being extremely critical of Ramana Maharshi's teachings and Nisargadatta Maharaj. Now, the person who is her friend, whom she was talking to and criticizing these masters, he said, but why be so critical of them? And she said, no, they took the shortcut. They are giving shortcuts to their disciples. We have worked hard. It's an 18-month Vedanta course. We have studied everything. Our teacher has made us line by line recite certain verses, so it imbibes, we imbibe it in our consciousness, and so on and so forth. That is a hard work. That is the way it must be done. Not these people who say, one says, who am I? The other says, I am that. You see, this is what happens. This is the whole problem, is the arrogance of the intellect. That is what I mean when I even say that meditation, there is no such thing as failure in meditation. There is no such thing as success in meditation. These are just labels, judgments put on to the process of meditation. So we have to be very careful, especially on the spiritual path, because there is no ego greater than the spiritual ego. Okay.
Yeah, Gautam, one last question. I mean, Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi says it, Nisargadatta Maharaj says it, even Lord Krishna says it in Bhagavad Gita, that once the body perishes, the soul takes birth in another new body. It's just changing its costumes, which is the body in this case. So in that case, Gautam, once a person leaves their body, why every year some rituals are being performed? Because that soul would have already taken birth in a new body. So what is the purpose, or what is the objective of doing this yearly annual rituals on the death anniversary, which is done periodically every year? Is there any significance to it?
There is bound to be a significance to it. Okay, there is bound to be. And you see, the whole point is me. What is more likely, the question of import is not the external ritual, but what is our association with the person who has passed? What is our thinking process? What is the internal ritual The remembrance, you can call the remembrance a ritual. You see? So some people follow the hardline scriptures as this is what is said, the Shraddh ceremony, and so on and so forth. You see, because there are things laid out which are ancient, which we have no understanding of today. But some people are not inclined for that. But not being inclined for something does not mean putting it down. You see, that is very important to remember. Sometimes the highest teachings say that rituals are encoded in us. When we perform certain rituals, certain energies get activated within ourselves. You know, there's a ritual, for example, in Hinduism, which is connected with a certain dosha, like a Kal Sarp dosha and this and that in Indian astrology. Now, in the Western world, they have equally beautiful rituals. Some names are like family constellation, which are all based on sorting out family ties with those who have passed on and so on. So it's the same thing in a different expression. So if you ask me personally what is happening, why are they doing this year upon year upon year, all I can say is I do not know the actual reason, but they are doing it because it is their belief system, their conditioning, and that cannot be something which is on a flaky foundation. It is our knowledge which perhaps is not adequate enough to know about that. In fact, you know, years ago, I had accompanied my sister and brother-in-law, maybe 15 years ago, 10, 12, I don't know, I've lost track. And there was one quite a beautiful ritual, you know, what they do. They make a small puppet of a body and they do something which is like a mock cremation. You know, you light the fire and you bless and you chant. And I thought that was so symbolic actually. I didn't view it only as a ritual and something to be done mechanically. For me, it was more of something like a letting go, you know, a letting go of the form and a release. And I'm quite clear that the science behind these is pretty intense and reaches somewhere quite distant. Okay. Yes, Mahantesh.
Hi, Gautam. Good morning. Hello. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can't see you, but I can hear you.
Yeah, there is some problem with the camera, so that's why my photo is not there. The question is related to non-doership, right? So, if I am not the doer, then whatever happens, it's a will of God and it's coming from the source, right? So, I understood that, but at the same time, there will be sometimes, you know, there will be a thinking of the jiva, not the atma. Means we think about the body, we think of our mind, and again, suddenly we come out of that and again start, you know. Usually this happens, maybe let's take one example of this COVID case only, right? Sometimes we'll be more worried about our children or more worried about the elder people in the family, right? So when we go out and come back, then we'll be a little bit thinking and we'll be restricting our family members, like don't go here, there. So that kind of tension will be there, right? If, see, how to handle that tension, and I can think in one way, I'm not the doer and whatever happens, let it be God's will. So how to take this, you know, how to balance these two things? One is, surrender total to the God and say that let it happen whatever happens, or at the same time, you know, we need to take measures, but no, let it have if it is it's we do our action and let the results be in the God's hand. So how to really balance this, that's my dilemma.
Well, Mahantesh, to put it in a nutshell, because if you look at all the previous videos, if you read any of the books, this is all already explained, but in a nutshell, it is trust in God, but lock your car. Do what you think you should do. in any given situation, knowing that the results are not in your control. It is as simple as that. Now, this reminds me of a joke. I don't know if it's a joke or a true story or what. It's about Mullah Nasruddin. So he was driving one day pretty rashly, and he banged into a parked car, and the cops came. And they made him fill out a form. What time did you leave your house? What time did the accident happen? What were you doing the night before? And so on and so forth. And the last form to be filled was that, would you say if you would have or could have done anything differently in order to avoid this accident? And he put there, absolutely not. If the other person hadn't parked his car there, I would not have banged into it. You see, that's what we do. We always blame the other for doing something. It's quite strange. Okay. Yes, Jayashree.
Good morning, Gautamji.
Morning.
Meditation brings so much peace, but your presence does bring so much peace. I don't know what magic that is all about. My question is, what does Advaita say about celibacy?
Advaita says absolutely nothing about celibacy.
Okay.
Do exactly that which you think and feel you should do.
Okay.
Simple. In fact, I would go further to say that any extreme positions already manifest the opposite. And that is why Osho would say that people who renounce things are in fact obsessed by that which they are repelled by, because they've already created the polaric opposite, you see. They are working at the extremities. And that is why the middle path, the middle way, was what the Buddha pointed at. Celibacy, for example, not as an external act, extreme external act. His focus was more on the thoughts, on the thinking. That is why the middle way, the middle path, the still point of the pendulum that is not swinging between the extreme opposites. Because any extreme position taken can swing back covertly or its opposite violently to the other end. So I don't know the context of your question, but do keep this in mind. And like I said, everyone is free to do whatever they think and feel they should do, knowing that the results are not in their hand. Okay?
Thanks, Gautamji.
Okay, thank you. So now I hope I get this pronunciation correct. Kurali?
Wow, that's correct. Hello, Gautamji. Gautamji, the question is, I've been part of a few sessions of meditation. My Guruji, Rishi Prabhakarji, and we call it as Siddha Samadhi Yoga, Samadhi meditation. That means we don't follow thoughts. We don't, generate thoughts. We'll just witness. If meditation happens during that session, that means in our minds, there's nothing. The end, it's not a goal, but if it happens naturally, there's nothing. That's why it's called Samadhi Yoga. And in some meditation, some spiritual organization, they chant particular, you know, they focus on one point or chant one particular mantra or something like that. So there are different forms of meditation. I'm trying to understand based on what you explained today. So if you can tell us why different forms and what is the idea of these different forms?
Very simply put, all roads lead to the same destination. People are born with different inclinations. They will walk the road which they are inclined to. Some may be inclined to Nama Japa chanting. Purpose is the same. It frees the mind when the focus is only on the mantra. Some may be born inclined to a particular technique of Kriya Yoga, for example. Some are drawn to Bhakti Yoga. Some are drawn to Shakti Yoga of the Kundalini and the Chakras. Some are drawn to Jnana Yoga. So everyone is ultimately drawn to the path which they are meant to be on. And in fact, Goraknath himself had devised more than 80,000 ways to reach God. You see, there are 6 billion people on the planet, if not more now, I don't know. So they are bound to be various ways. None is better than the other. They may claim to be better than the other, but ultimately it is the individual and their journey of life. And as I always say, the gift, the measure is by the degree of peace that one feels in one's daily living. Okay. Let's end on sitting in silence. And I would like to share with you all one story, because it came up when I was speaking with someone who was going through a rough patch, quite a rough patch. And this came up, so I felt it's appropriate to share it today. The strange thing is that the rough patch did not seem that rough to me, but then when a person is consumed by what they are going through, they know their suffering because it is based on that. But to the outside, someone might say, my God, is that what you call a rough patch? I have been through much worse. You see? Let's see all of you. This is the story of Baldwin, a boy called Baldwin. Baudouin, as they say in French. When he was born, his mother left him. She was asked to leave. So Baldwin didn't know a mother's love. When he was 13, his father died suddenly. No father's love after that. Now, it so happened that Baldwin's father was the king of Jerusalem. So Baldwin was crowned king at the age of 13. Now it so happened that the Crusades were going on, and the mighty Saladin's army was to be fought. By the young king, who had regents appointed to help him since he was so young. But a boy with no mother, no father, with the fear of a mighty army to be fought. Yet, managed to deflect Saladin's army, distract it. And when Baldwin was 15, he was ready to lead the battles by himself. So it is told. Now the thing is, when Baldwin was 9, and he fell down playing, and his father took him to the doctor, his hand was injured. The doctor was surprised. And the doctor told the then king, "Your Majesty, your child has leprosy." When Baldwin was 15, the king of Jerusalem, leading the armies, he could hold the reins of his horse with only one hand because of the leprosy. At that time, it was the 1100s, 900 years ago. To have leprosy means you were an outcast, not to be looked at again, not to be touched. But for some strange reason, it is believed that all the people wanted Baldwin as their king, despite the leprosy. Now, can you imagine a boy with such a destiny? No mother's love, no father from the age of 13. With the most debilitating disease called leprosy, crowned the king of Jerusalem, wondering when he would die at the hands of his enemy. How long would he fight battles for? No mother and father to go back to for comfort after a hard day. Yet, the king of Jerusalem. And towards the end, he could not mount his horse. It is believed that the last couple of times he got carried into battle on a stretcher. And when the leprosy affected his face, started eating into his eyes, he decided to abdicate. And the people said, "No, you are our king." And so Baldwin the IV died at the age of 23. Remembered in history books as the Leper King. That is what he is remembered by. Not the life of Baldwin, the suffering, the hand of destiny dealt to him, the king, and yet a leper, whose lifespan lasted all of 23 years, which actually is the age where our normal lives begin. There are so many Baldwins among us today we don't know about. So many people are suffering unimaginable suffering. And that is why my teacher used to tell those who came to him with heavy psychological suffering, he would say, think of millions below the poverty line whose suffering is far worse than yours. And then perhaps you may thank God for your suffering, knowing it could have been much worse. Much, much worse. And if you feel you have suffered a lot, much more than what others seem to have suffered, know that you are not alone, because there are others too who have suffered a lot. Be thankful to God. That is why my teacher would say, the true prayer to God is the prayer of gratitude. He actually said the only true prayer is the prayer of gratitude. Before we end for today, couple of things. One is that many of you all have seen the podcasts which are being coming up on maybe some social media platform. The podcasts are where I give short audio talks of about 10 minutes. Each podcast is roughly 10-12 minutes. And I believe many emails are coming asking how to access these podcasts. It's very simple. There's something called Patreon. And Sangeeta will put the link in the chat for you to see. A Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. So that is the platform where these podcasts are placed. Now, these podcasts are on different themes. Some are on daily living, some are on quotations of my lineage, which have impacted me, and some are questions and answers. For this, some are put up free, and access to all is for a contribution of a minimum $1 a month. So if that's something you would like to listen to and something you can contribute for, because that contribution goes towards the expenses which we are incurring now in running various aspects of the technology behind the teaching. So that is about Patreon. Secondly, some of you have perhaps missed out because last Sunday there was no talk and you were not clear about it. If you need to be informed of the talk's schedule, there's a mailing list link on the website. So every month, we post the dates of the talk for the month. And if there are other newsletters with important updates, you will receive those. If you add your email address on that link, the mailing list link. Lastly, the room is kept open after each satsang for y'all to meet each other if you would like to, share your experiences if you would like to. And the reason for this is that you are with like-minded people and not separated by boundaries. I made a large number of friends. In the 15 minutes post Rameshji's satsangs, when you would all hang around in the living room and chat, chit-chat, where are you from, what do you do? And I'm so grateful to God because I am in touch with so many of them, even after 10 years of his passing. The term for this is Guru Bandhus, Guru brothers and sisters, all bound by the teaching, the Guru as consciousness, not by social roles and so on. So if it appeals to you, just so that you know that at the end of each talk, this room is open for a bit and y'all can communicate with each other. As I have been saying, perhaps you'll have got bored of me saying it, but volunteers have come forward and we are finding a lot of assistance in various tasks. And especially now the talks are being transcribed, for which I need to thank Bhargavi Shankar and Kohla Rajkumaran. And really thank you for this seva, because these things can only happen, you see. And generally I have seen that they happen when the teaching hits the heart. I'd like to thank a few others. Rahul is helping us with the website support, and we are getting some support from the Spanish audience. We have Michael, who's translating my book, The Buddha Sword, into Spanish. We have Satsang recently. We have another one coming up. And we have Veronica Font, who is helping with Spanish subtitles and with a bit of graphic design. And we are still looking for help composing. It would be great. We're already getting help in that department, but need more. And I think, yeah, that about covers the current list of items. Be well and stay safe.